Session number 7363, George Jameson, part 18.
Can I go back to the war and ask you some more questions? First of all, could I ask you about your life as an officer compared to your life when you were in the ranks? Was it very different?
Oh, yes. Not to a very marked degree. We had more creature comforts. On the other hand, when I was in the ranks, I had very little responsibility. As a young corporal, I was given control of men. I had to do certain jobs with them, but that's as far as my responsibility extended. And I knew nothing about what the regiment were doing, where they were doing it, or why they were doing it, or anything. I knew nothing about strategy. I knew nothing about. This was simply a question of go here, do this, do that, take up, carry a party and do this job. That was it, finish. But after that, when I became commissioned, it was nice to be looked after and have a batman and get things done for you. But I'd always felt the batman was another fellow just like me, and I always liked to treat him properly. And he'd been made deaf by gun blasts, so he was no good for the guns, but a very nice fellow, and I looked after him, and he looked after me. We were great friends, really. Now, apart from that, we were very fortunate in having a first-class man in command. He wasn't just a soldier. He was a man who'd been well away up in commerce. He knew how to handle men, and he knew also how to care for them, and he did. And the battery to a man would have followed him anywhere. They just worshipped him. He was a glorious fellow and so unassuming and yet so courageous in every way. And we really did think the world of him, even now. But on top of that, because it had been a territorial battery and had the major and all the officers had known these fellows, Durham miners, in their own homes, we were a very close-knit concern, and we felt very much for each other, and we were very concerned about each other. And as a result of that, it was, although the ordinary army rule used to be horses, men, and then you, sort of thing, and looking after yourself, we would carry that very much further. And fellows used to come to us and ask us about something that was going on at home, and advice about what they ought to do, and if they were in a bit of trouble, we used to get them special leave to go and deal with things like that. Oh, we were a very close-knit family, and that went on right through to the war, and we suffered their sorrows as though they were our own.
As an officer, in your role as officer, the fact that you'd been in the ranks.
Yes, very much so.
Why is that?
I had a great appreciation for what it was like to be in the ranks, and therefore I was very much more ready to listen to somebody in the ranks talking back to me. I hadn't much time for the tin soldier, I may say. I hadn't much time for the fellow who would slap his leg with a cane and try to give orders. I would ask people to do things. Of course, at times it was a question of just orders. But generally speaking, it was a cooperative unit in which we endeavoured to get the best out of people, and we went to great lengths to explain why and wherefore. And don't get so sick in the mouth about so and so and so and so. I'm having to put up with it just as much as you. For God's sake, be a man, you know, that sort of thing. Face up to this. We've got to do it. It's no good bucking the... You don't get yourself anywhere. Let's do it cheerfully rather than not. I said that we absolutely would have... Anybody would have gone anywhere for the major. He was a fine fellow. Now, as an example, for instance, I remember one very sticky job. We'd been hammered about. We'd been knocked about. We'd been battered. The battery was in a very sort of shot-up state. They felt they needed rest rather than work. And then suddenly, in filthy weather conditions, we suddenly get instructions that we've got to take parties to go and do so-and-so and prepare this to move somewhere else. And we thought we were due to have a bit of a rest. We'd been bashed. There was considerable unrest amongst the men and disgruntlement about all this. And obviously, of course, to take these parties again with get on preparing positions would have been a subaltern's job, a conducting officer. But Drew sensed all this unrest, and he came along and said, "Look, you fellows, you leave this alone. I'm going to take these fellows." He took the men, and he was the conducting officer. He went and suffered their sloshing through the mud and the wet and the rain and black, dark night and filth and so forth. Was one of them and helped them. And he did it deliberately to let them see that if he could put up with that cheerfully and get on with the war, who were they to kick up a noise? That was the kind of man he was.
Was he exceptional? You know, were there many like him, would you say? Or did some of them prefer to keep a distance with the men?
Well, we more or less rubbed shoulders with the regular soldier. In the officer class we did. Career soldiers, and they took rather a different attitude to life from what we did in many cases. On the other hand, there were quite a number who were just as human as we were, and most enjoyable people to cooperate with.
Do you think the quality of officers varied?
Yes.
Either for good or ill as the war progressed? Could you give me some information about that?
Well, I think to some degree it improved. You see, I think the civilian soldier, if he took a liking to military life and settled for it, had a broader spectrum of life than the career soldier. The fellow who'd just gone into the army and known nothing else from school and so on and so forth, he was a bit out of touch with the ordinary humanities in the way that a man who had been in business, couldn't help but study the situation from a business point of view. And I think that was better. And I think for that reason, the quality, if you got the officers who were brave enough and courageous and fellows and good goers in every other way, their civilian life background was better. It was more helpful. I think so.
And the recruitment broadened out, did it?
Yes.
About 1916, would you say? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why was that? Was it because of the losses?
Yes, the losses. The losses in the beginning were terrific and stupid. And even later, when the losses were more conservative and people thought a bit more about what they'd commit people to before they did it, and that sort of thing weighed up all the disadvantages and advantages. You still come back in the end to the fact that war is a waste of time, it's a waste of manpower, it's a waste of material, and it gets nobody anywhere. And generally speaking, the victors are the people who come off worst. I mean, you've only got to look at Germany. We sent our trade unions over to Germany. We re-equipped Germany with all the money that was poured into it to set up their heavy industries again. We got the whole show going. And where they benefited in Germany from, apart from the material and stuff we poured into it and the expertise we put in to establish the trade, the fact that we sent our trade union leaders over there, and instead of putting in the moribund old trade union setup we've got here, they put in an up-to-date setup in Germany, which is infinitely better than ours. They don't have all the trade restrictions that we have here. Why? Because these fellas did the right thing over there. Why they can't do it in our own country, I don't know. They're coming to sense, I hope.
That's after the Second World War you're talking about.
Yes, but it's that was they did that. We did to some degree did that in the First World War. We helped them on. We put a lot of money into Germany after this, even though they talked about reparations. We never got the reparations, not in any to any extent. The French, of course, were very bitter about it, very naturally so, because it was their country. The fight had gone over, and there they lost a lot of people. But the reparations didn't benefit us by draining Germany. They simply depressed a very large area of the world that should have been in active commerce and was not, and the world suffered as a result of it.
How important was it it for you during the war to have your comrades around you? Was some comradeship important?
Oh, very, very, very important. And you know what? One most astounding thing about the war I found, and it cropped up time and time again, you found the most amazing courage and the most amazing behaviour in the most astounding circumstances and from the most astonishing people. Some fellows that you wouldn't have given a couple of winks for in civilian life blossomed forth in the war in a way that you never have given credit for, you know. That happened time and time again. A most unassuming, unexpected sort of bloke would suddenly turn out to be the most first great fellow you could have beside you. You know, it was wonderful.
Can you think of any special individuals that spring to mind? You mentioned once Jones, wasn't it, Jones?
Oh, Jonah, he came to us. I say we called him the almost human. He was about square and he was terrifically powerful a fella. He was a pentathlon expert and he would insist on standing out stark naked in full view of the world and the Germans in particular while he cold bathed himself and he ate marron glacé before breakfast, which we couldn't abide. But when he first arrived with us at Newport, away from us, at least half a mile away, there was some shelling going on, and he arrived and he said, it stopped. And he said, Major, do you think I could walk over there and have a look at those shell holes? I've never seen one before. And Drew said, look here, Jones, that's just stopped now. You get over there. By the time you get over there, they'll probably put another salvo down on that place, and you might just well not have come here, right? We wonder. We needed the reinforcement, but he was that sort of fellow, and he was fearless. And he did go and look at things like that. And as for example, he didn't want to go to Italy, which was a nice soft war because there was no fighting going on there. He wanted to be in France. He got at this position, as I told you, in Newport, where we had the guns and this ammunition lying out. He was saved by falling behind these boxes with four shells in each and very badly sliced up. Nobody thought he would live. I was at the OP. Drew was away at some conference of battery commanders. Jones was on the battery position in a payout. I've got a photograph of it somewhere. And then this shelling started. And as he went towards the guns, the salvo dropped just behind them and he got quite a lot of it. They rang me up at the OP and I said, well, of course, I can't come away from here. I can't leave this position. But this and this and this is what you do. I got the NCO who had spoken to me on the telephone, organized to get in contact with them, and so on, so on, so on, so on. Got Jonah away from the position. Well, he was in hospital from the time we left there. Eventually, we went to Italy. We stayed in Italy for 6 months and we came back. By that time, Jonah had mended and we found he joined us again in France. Well, again, he goes off fire-eating, you see, and he's on this FO job, Brigade FO, and he gets machine gun bullet through the head. I think it went through his cheeks, as a matter of fact. Again, taken home, and he was a fine fellow. But he didn't seem to have any fear about it. In spite of having been nearly killed on this previous occasion, he was out there again without any worry. And as I say, his father was so grateful at getting him home in one piece and hopefully that he would put him back into civilian life eventually that he bought this private park and gave it to South End Corporation as a thank offering.
Are there any other people that stand out in your mind?
Cook Jones, the troop officer we had, was a very nice man. We were very lucky, as a matter of fact, with our battery officers. Chink Lennox, that was, from Jardines. He was a very useful bloke. Ballum, and that was Sadler, he came from Ballum. He was a nice fellow. He and I had a spell in Brussels together. We were very lucky with the, really. We did get one or two officers who, Drew used to say, they got into the army by standing at the corner of the seat and slapping their leg with a cane, you know, that sort of thing. If anybody wasn't any good, we gradually got them promoted to some soft job somewhere. That was an amazing thing, a habit in the army, and I think it went right through. There were various soft jobs that were going behind, you know. And if you found somebody that was useless or a nuisance, they weren't... you would be better off without them. Then the thing to do was to find another job for them somewhere else and get them promoted or removed. And we did shed a lot of people that way. Get them jobs somewhere else.
Did you ever see any members of the royal family at the front or behind the lines?
Yes, when I was in the yeomanry, the King George V came out to inspect the troops, and the 7th Division had to send a small contingent there. I wasn't part of the contingent, although I was on the spot. We had just a cadre, from each lot, as a representative of the whole lot, and he rode there. He had a bad accident. His horse, I think, reared a bit and threw him. He carried through and finished the job, and I saw the Prince of Wales on one or two occasions. He was a real pain in the neck for the Hedians, the higher ups, you know, because he wanted to be in the middle of everything, as he did right throughout his life, really, always getting into things. And I can remember seeing him on one or two occasions on a pushbike when we were the front line wasn't very far away, and we were perhaps in a support position, and he would come pushing along this communications road on a pushbike with his ADC tagging along behind them and fed to the teeth. And on another occasion, I can remember we were coming out, and our role as a cavalry screen very soon vanished when the war settled down to trench warfare. And then, of course, some of the squadrons sections were posted to brigades as gallopers for the brigadier. Some bits of the sections were used for communication work. Some of the squadrons were actually used in the trenches direct. I had quite a regular spell in and out in reserve, but during the actual battles, the seasoned troops were put in as the attacking force, and we were the support lot who sort of fetched and carried for them and kept them in being, kept the communication going, that sort of thing. Some people might say that wasn't a bad thing to have, but to try and just carry on cold-bloodedly, trying to do communications when you knew the bit you had to go through was being curtained by a nice little 5-9 knock-up, you felt you had to sort of run a mile around it to get past things and that sort of thing. It wasn't a... things were sticky, you know, but then the war was sticky. Everybody had to put up with it.
Could I ask you now about punishments for troops? Did you ever have to mete out punishment to your soldiers?
No, I hadn't. When I was in the yeomanry, we had a young fellow called Cyril Fletcher. He was a ship broker, as a matter of fact, and he was a small fellow and a little bit assertive, but very intelligent. And he was also quite well-to-do. He didn't like the khaki uniform that we were dished out with, so when he was first home on leave, he got himself one made, which was exactly the same in every way, but it was much nicer material and smarter. And Fanny Burrell, the major, took a scunner at him. He didn't like this. He didn't like Cyril Fletcher's uppityness either, and his sort of general attitude of saying, well, I'm as good as you sort of attitude, and my brain is as good as yours kind of behavior. So Fletcher ran into trouble in a very short time, and eventually such trouble that he was sent off for a course of field punishment number one.
What is that?
It used to be, of course, that old Kipling story, they used to be tied to the stretcher out on the gun wheel, but that's gone. But they were put into what they called jenkers. They used to go to prison. They used to have to... I never experienced it in any way. I never even saw the place, but Cyril Fletcher had a rough time there. You see, he was bossed about by military police. He was ordered to do this and that, and he would get defaulters and all sorts of things. He was the only case that I can remember of anybody in the regiment, in the Yeomanry Regiment, who ran into trouble like that. It was simply because he was an independent thinking sort of fellow, and Burrell was a stuffed shirt. He couldn't come down to earth and try and understand things at all. He couldn't even get hold of a fellow and just talk to him in a common sense point of way, not like Drew Common would have done. He was no manager of men, was Burrell. No, none whatever.
Did you ever see any evidence of deserters or mutinies while you were at the front? Did you ever hear of any in your vicinity?
There were some occasions, I believe. I was never anywhere near them. I did see on occasions a bunch of prisoners doing work in the rear areas on roads. They had been run in for jobs and put onto this navvying work because of their behaviour. It used to be, I know it used to be at the beginning that people who deserted in the face of the enemy were shot, and I believe it happened. But I never saw any evidence of it.
Do you think there was ever sympathy for people, you know, who couldn't stand it, like the man you described earlier, who just simply had to run out of the dugout into the night, into the wet? Would there have been any sympathy for people who just couldn't stand the bombardment?
Well, it took a long time. It took towards 2 years, I should think, of the war, before that began to sink in to the powers that be. And it came about, I think, to a large degree, because the Germans had a weapon they called a Minenwerfer. And one of those, you would be up to in the trenches, and if one of those landed somewhere near, it blew a hole about the size of this room, and the trench vanished completely, and everything that was there vanished. And if the Germans did this Minenwerfer business very regularly, it so shattered the nerves of the troops that they had to be withdrawn. They were just shell-shocked, jittering. They were no good. And that was, when that started to happen, it was then begun to be realized that troops that were subjected not to actual wounds and things, but simply to the devastating effect of gun blast on top of them repeatedly, and shook their nervous systems to such an extent that they were no good. They couldn't think straightly, and had to be sent away for a period of rehabilitation.
Would they have been regarded as cowards by...
No, not then. In the beginning, yes. In the beginning, when people... And of course, naturally, right, even right to the beginning, but not perhaps so much. It wasn't appreciated that it wasn't a question of bullets and shell splinters that was the cause of the trouble. It was sheer threatening noise and pulsation of the air around you that was shaking people's nerves to the extent that they just didn't know what they were doing. It took some time for that to be appreciated, and I think in my experience of the front I was on during that time, that this constant Minenwerfer business was the thing that did it. It brought that home very rapidly to the powers that be, the troops subjected to frontline blasting like that without actually being wounded, hit or anything. It was something they just couldn't stand.
Did you ever feel desperate under those circumstances?
Not to that extent, I don't think. I think the nearest I came to being in that sort of setup was the time we spent on the ridge after we'd taken the Vimy Ridge. Being up there, the the squalor, the rain, the discomfort, everything to drive you into the mud and depress you and reduce your morale, was there to do it if you were prepared to give in to it. It took an awful lot to sort of keep your head above water sort of feeling. And there again, we had these people with us who would do it. And in the middle of all this, a sudden bright sunny day, and you get a driving display of a battery wagon with six horses attached to it, doing a beautiful circular ride from about half a mile away, and the troops all round watching this thing, standing up and cheering like fun, as though there wasn't a war going on.
You did manage to get fun, it seems.
Oh, yes. Yes, we did. And we looked for it. Even in, as I said, even in that the worst possible time we had, I think, was when we were being bashed. We actually shifted the guns physically in this muddy condition an odd 100 yards to try and hope that they would keep their guns on that line and we'd just miss all this. And living in a trench which was no deeper than the top of that thing there, with a gun sheet on balks of timber over it, and boxes and things to sit on, and the battery map and this lamp, and all the time that you are trying to get things ready and arrange your fire programs and whatnot and follow out, interpret instructions you'd got, you were getting these salvos of 5.9s dropping around the place and this whole place dancing like that. The only other time that happened was when we were very near this Guards training battalion when they dropped those bombs. And there again, luck was with us. Five bombs that were instant detonation things that cut everything off at about 18 inches high. And then the sixth one, the 200-pounder sort of job, dropped. And happened to be the last one to be dropped and fell in Plough, which dug this great crater that I've got a picture of. And all we knew was, of course, we were lying in these graves in the trenches. There were two of us in each tent in a grave, and the stuff that came through and cut the hedge to the back of us ripped through our tent tops. But when this went, it just, all the earth went into the air and just flattened the tents out, and we were crawling out from under tent poles and guy ropes and God knows what, and the horses gone all over the countryside.